local talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host today, Paul Wearson, together with Ursula Rudenberg. And hello to you out there who are listeners for our station.
As we get started, let's do a quick weather check, Paul.
Well, it looks like we're in for a reprieve. Sunny days are predicted through Sunday, but temperatures should remain in the 80s. Friday is expected to be in the upper 80s, but it should drop down again, and we should have a pleasant weekend in store.
Checking in with the natural world, I looked at the website for Ada Hayden Park and saw a beautiful photograph of coneflowers and grasses. I think you will agree that the flowers are just magnificent this year. Here in Central Iowa, everywhere we look, and that includes in town and outside of town, I'm finding the areas next to the highways particularly beautiful this year, the wildflowers. Also, Irv Kloss reports on Ada Hayden Park's website that the wetlands in the middle complex of the park area is 90% covered with sago pondweed, and this is the way the wetlands should be looking.
Well, what is sago pondweed, you might ask?
Sago pondweed is a perennial water plant that arises from thickly matted root masses or rhizomes, and it has thin, long, highly branching, hairy-looking stems with very thin and filament-like leaves that grow in thick layers, and there's no floating leaves. In other words, it is those yucky plants you don't want touching your legs when you swim in a shallow lake. The sago pondweed will take up nitrogen from the water and helps keep it out of the lake. The plant also produces a winter tuber in the bottom sediment that is a favorite food for diving ducks.
On Thursday, July 30th, the Friends of Ada Hayden Heritage Park are hosting Dr. James Peace, who will lead a tour along the trails and discuss some of the famous Iowa conservationists who are pictured in stone at the park. And he will speak also on the topic of what makes a person a conservationist. Again, that will be a tour of the park led by Professor Jim Peace on Thursday, tomorrow, July 30th at 5:30.
And on the topic of conservationists, this is a moment to note. A historic person in that field just passed away. Pat Schlarbaum, KHOI's resident naturalist, informed me 2 days ago that Bob Anderson died suddenly of heart failure. You may know about Bob Anderson because he has spoken on KHOI a number of times, and he's very well known for creating and maintaining the Decorah Eagle webcam at a fish hatchery located in Decorah, Iowa, that is seen and treasured by millions around the world. Bob was the director of an organization called the Raptor Resource Center, and condolences have been pouring in to the center from across the globe. Although Bob was famous for the Decorah Eagle cam, his passion and greatest legacy really is the reintroduction of the peregrine falcon, which is nesting in the upper Midwest. Bob moved to Iowa from Minnesota in 1997 when wildlife officials here agreed to let him release peregrine falcons on the river bluffs in northeast Iowa along the Mississippi. By 2000, there were 5 nesting pairs, and by this year, there were 21 nesting pairs, all but 2 directly tied to Anderson's work. Pat Schlarbaum, who was involved with facilitating Bob's work, told the Des Moines Register, "I always told Bob he picked up where Rachel Carson left off. She'd wanted us to hear and see the birds on these cliffs. Bob made that happen. You can't get a much fuller life than Bob's on this planet." Pat Schlarbaum was actually right in the process of producing the show for KHOI on how Bob introduced the peregrine falcons to Iowa, and was kind of right in the middle of doing that. We're looking forward to when Pat has the time to come by KHOI and speak directly in his own words about Bob and his environmentalist work in Iowa and the whole story of Bob's vision and accomplishments.
Well, today is Wednesday, so we're looking out around the state of Iowa, and today we're traveling a little further in time and space than we usually do. We're going to look at a major historic event in Iowa, the farm crisis of the 1980s. We're fortunate to have Dr. Neil E. Harrell here with us today to explain that historic event better and to help us put it in context today and to explain some of the economics of agriculture also. And he'll be joining us soon in the second segment of the show.
Yes, we're excited about that. I'm looking forward to learning a lot today about this. We wanted to start off with a radio production that offers a firsthand account of what happened. This is a mini documentary told from the perspective of someone who experienced this event as a life-defining influence. Joe Hanek was a student at Iowa State University who came from southern Iowa in the first decade of this century. He actually was an engineering student, but he and his mother wrote a musical about their experience as farmers during the farm crisis. They performed the musical in Ames and eventually were accepted in the New York City Fringe Festival, and he and his family literally drove from Iowa to New York in a pickup truck, where they performed the musical called Farmer Song for approximately a week. As you will hear in the production we're about to play, I met up with them in New York in 2007 and saw their pickup truck and exchanged news about Ames, and he recorded his history in a restaurant in Greenwich Village. Excerpts from the music from his play are also included in this production, which I put together shortly after speaking with Joe. Today, Joe works in Des Moines as an engineer, but he has his home in Murray, Iowa, out of which he also happens to be running a radio station, KSOI Community Radio. But that's another story. Let's listen to Joe's story about farming in the 1980s now. Afterwards, we'll discuss this event and economics in general with Dr. Neil Haar, Distinguished Professor in Agriculture and Emeritus Professor of Economics at Iowa State University. Joe Haina grew up in a small family farm in southern Iowa. Like many who grew up during the farm crisis of the 1980s, Joe chose a different profession. He is an engineer and also a musician and playwright. Joe and his mother, Angie Hainick, created Farmer Song, a musical inspired by and set around the farm crisis of the 1980s. Farmer Song was accepted in New York City's Fringe Theater Festival in August of 2007. While in New York City with his 15-person cast, Joe sat down with me in a cafe and described how his musical is linked with his family's experience during the farm crisis.
My name's Joe Hienick, and I grew up in Beaconsfield, Iowa. Actually, that town was the smallest town in Iowa in the 2000 census, 8 people. So they closed their post office. It's in south central Iowa, right near the Missouri border. And after Beaconsfield closed, we started saying we were from Elston because it still had a post office and people could find it a little easier. I grew up on a small farm. It's about less than 300 acres, and we had like 2 tractors. Did all of our farming with a 100 horsepower tractor and 4-row equipment. All Iowa topsoil is black. You can make a ball out of it if it's just a little bit wet. You can dig out a handful and squeeze it into a ball, and it should hold together. And that's moisture that's making that stick together, and that's what crops need to grow. We farmed, we raised corn and beans, soybeans, and raised hay. We did crop rotation to help reduce our need for chemicals and keep, you know, pests out, and to help replenish the soil with nitrogen by planting beans before corn. And so we did everything we could to farm efficiently and by using less to make our crop valuable. My parents' land is rolling hills. We live in a 110-year-old Victorian house. It's a gray house with little scalloped shingles under the eaves. And we built a solarium on the front that fits the period. And in order to get some extra heat in there during the winter, and kind of monitor, it helps to cool down the, it has all these windows so it cools the house a little in the summer. And we have a gravel road bordering one side of our farm, a dirt road bordering the other side. Next to our land, there's a 10,000-acre game reserve, and it's nothing but trees and hills. People get lost in it all the time when they go hunting, and they come out lost in our farm and want to ride to their car. So it's pretty isolated. On the gravel road side of our farm, there's a private lake that has about 500 very nice, expensive homes on it. That's where we're able to sell our commercial trees. And but the community as a whole is, if you drive down the road, you'll pass, first you'll pass my neighbor's 2 old farmsteads with abandoned houses. One of them's they're both pretty old. Then you'll pass a trailer house that belongs to my other neighbor's son. He's farmed there for a long time, and he was able to hang on and have his sons all live around him. And then you'll get up, if you keep continuing down the gravel road, you'll come to Reasoner's Garage. It's a business that used to service lots of farmers, but now they've had to change, and they do more hay mowing equipment sales because all the land around us is in the CR, the Conservation Reserve Program, where you just mow it once a year. You don't farm it. Prior to the 1980s, things were going really well for farmers. Land prices had hit an all-time high, and they were raising corn and beans and hay, cattle, and hogs. Most guys who were doing hogs were doing a farrow to finish operation. That's where you breed the pigs, and then they have the babies, and then you take them through the full process till they're to market weight. And for cattle, it was kind of varied. Some people did feeders, some people did dairies. There used to be a lot of small dairy farms, and there, but that was the kind of, everything was a lot smaller scale, and everything matched that. Like, you could actually take a load of hogs to market, like 7 hogs in the back of your pickup truck, and sell them to a buyer who would collect a bunch and then send those off to the packing house. And the same went for the cattle. And the cattle, doing feeder cattle, the packing houses would send out buyers to your farm. And so it was a business where they would come to you and they would be interested in your product and want to entice you to sell your cattle to them.
Ground is tough. I'd be better off with a job in town, but I love raising corn, beans, pigs, and cows. My farm doesn't make much, it's a labor of love. There's no insurance, 401k pension, or stock. Your retirement plan is the kids you raise. If you haven't got any, you'll probably work to the grave, cause I'm not paid to plant, I'm not paid to plow. From the dawn until the sun goes down, I take my money and I bury it in the ground. And if it grows back, I might make it another round. Yeah, yeah. Crop prices have been the same for 40 years, but the rest of the world seems to get a raise. The only way to make it is to farm more.
Legislation that made it easier for large, huge farmers to start raising animals in really big volumes, then it kind of shut small farmers out. farmers used to be able to take their hogs to a buyer at a small price. Well, after the farm crisis hit, no longer could you take a small batch of hogs to a buyer. You actually had to schedule a delivery, and a lot of times that could take, you know, several weeks to get a slot for your hogs to go to the market. Same for the cattle. The cattle buyers no longer come out to the farm to buy cattle. You have to put your name in to get a slot on the grid to be able to deliver your animals and your product. So small farmers really get a, you know, it makes it difficult for them because their lot is not very attractive. So it usually takes a lot longer, and they have to keep feeding these animals more, and or, you know, they just have to wait, and it messes things up.
Banker, get your money out. I've come to town. I earned my credentials. I'm ready to settle down. I'm trying to make dreams come true. It won't happen on my own. I'm asking for your help. I need a loan. Need a loan. Can't do this on my own. I need a loan. I'm ready to build a home. I haven't been a grown-up long. My intentions are so strong. So please let me have a loan.
My dad moved off the farm from his dad and bought a farm right in the 1980s when the land prices were really high. And he was making his payments. There was no problem there keeping up. But the interest rates that you could borrow money for went really high in the 80s. And then everyone stopped buying farmland. And since it was at an all-time high, it took a real steep drop. And so what happened was all these guys had a lot of money borrowed that at this high interest rate. And when the land prices dropped, when the assets value dropped, then it triggered a chain reaction in the banks where their debt to asset ratio wasn't high enough. And so that forced banks to call in a lot of guys' notes. What happened was we went bankrupt. We could not come up with the money to cover our note when the bank called it in. And so we declared bankruptcy. When you go bankrupt, you have to sell off your assets to try to cover your notes. So we had to sell off our farm equipment, or quite a bit of it, and we were going to have to sell off our land. I think in bankruptcy you're allowed to keep your home, but when you're a farmer, your business and your home are the same. So when you have to sell off all your equipment, that means that you can't do your business so well then. It basically ended an era for a lot of farmers. Not only did it take down small farmers, but it took down small banks, because all these banks were defaulting. And between the, I think it was the savings and loan scandals, along with all these banks closing, they about defaulted on FDIC. They took, you know, that about went.
My name is Edmund Ferris. I'm the banker in town. Love this community and won't let them down. I run a clean ship and I guarantee your money will be safe when you leave it with me. I invest in farm people who work really hard, raising food and families out on their farm. There's no money to waste. These people are the kings of making every penny count. They're in a squeeze. They're honest. Decisions, but I fear I made a mess. The bank's been here for 50 years, never seen times like this. I don't know what to do. This crisis might shut us down. I'm the only one who knows we could lose this town. They're honest, stubborn, live life simple. I'd like to point a finger and shake my fist at the people or persons done this. inside, I'm honest, stubborn, simple.
Joe and his mother, Angie Hanek, created Farmer Song, a musical inspired by the farm crisis of the 1980s. Joe Hanek.
There was a big change for, like, the family structure in rural America. After the farm crisis, most farm wives had to get jobs and start working. And so what that ended was that ended, like, church dinners and a lot of clubs that did community service things around the town. It pushed forward daycare and things like that, that where you ship your kids off to preschool or whatever, and they're no longer getting as much personal attention at home. You used to be able to just talk with your neighbors. You'd drive by their house and you know, you'd chat and you'd work together to get, you know, to help each other build fence or something like that. And that kind of ended because, you know, now you'll have people still living on the farm, but it's not their business to do that. It changed all those things. Like our church, went to the Beaconsfield Methodist Church. It used to have, like, you know, 30 families at it. It's a small town, very small town. And it went down to about half that. The small towns, like, you know, less than 1,000 people, they used to all have at least, you know, like a gas station and some sort of little dime store. And those things went out of business. So now you don't have that either. The schools all have decreasing population in them. We have the lowest population county in Iowa. It's 5,000 people. They shut down all the small schools, and everyone started being bused to one school that's at the county seat. So my bus ride to school was an hour and 15 minutes. I traveled 22 miles to get there. It's just devastating what the farm crisis did to the communities of Iowa. The small towns allow you to be a unique individual and be noticed by people, so there's a real strong sense of community. I've traveled the world, been to places like Shanghai and Beijing and London and New York and all around. And in the city, it's very hard to be noticed. It's just a sea of people. And so I feel bad that it's made our population as a whole less noticed, and it's a little harder to pull together to get things done. It's still a great place to be, but I'd sure like to see the pendulum swing back the other way and see some sort of businesses start again out there where people can move back to the country and move back to the rural towns.
It's been 6 whole years since I gave up the farm. I work like a madman most times. No time for family, just time for my chores. After harvest, I was broke. So what's going on, Mr. Greenspan? Why can't you figure this one out? You must be a cowboy, 'cause you rode the bull. Why can't you wrangle a circumstance hasn't made your job easy, and farming might be out of control. So what's going on, Mr. Greenspan? Why can't you figure this one out?
Our situation was unique. We had a stepfather that had a business that wasn't agriculturally related, and he went ahead and bought our farm and then began renting it to us. So for years we rented the farm, and then finally we started to buy it back from him. We set up a deal, and we continued on with the same type of farm with corn and beans, hogs, farrow to finish, and the cattle. And, you know, it didn't work. It just wasn't working because the prices were so low on all of those commodities. Finally, it got to a point where we started giving up different things, like we gave up our hog business. My dad got a second job working at a county extension. It was not one of his favorite things, but you have to do what you have to do. My mom got a job working as a secretary for a small church. And so finally, we had to move to getting an off-farm income. And what that meant was, with your land, you couldn't make a living where you lived. You had to go someplace where there was more people and there was a need for a job or whatever. And so we started trucking. And that was a way to get away from the physical location of Ringgold County and start to bring in money from somewhere else to pay our bills and to buy our farm. And we also did pit pumping. That was a business that worked for our area because Ringgold County was some of the cheapest land in the state, not so populated, so a lot of hog buildings were put up there for the larger corporate hog farms. And they have very large manure pits that need to be pumped once a year. And so with our truck, we do that, and we started making a lot better money than we were just farming. I decided to write Farmer Song, the musical, because I had been writing songs about farming because I felt like, I guess it just happened naturally, but after thinking about it, I decided that was kind of my way of giving up farming. I've gone on to study engineering and become a mechanical engineer. I also studied agricultural engineering. And by writing the songs, I was kind of saying goodbye to not being able to take over the farm after Dad's using it because there's just not enough income for two families there. Anyway, the musical, I felt, told an untold story. It's modern history. It's a very difficult story to explain. So I felt like I was in a good situation to do that, and it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed singing about farming and sharing that with people. And one of the most painful things of the farm crisis was changing. And I think by writing the play, it helps people to, in other situations, to better adapt and go with the punches a little better. I just decide you get to choose one or two things that you really love in your life, and that's what you're going to do. It may be the place where you live, that's your thing, or the occupation, or the person who you love. But all the rest of the chips, they're going to just fall wherever. And so you're going to have to deal with those in order to keep the one dream that you have. For us, that meant changing from farming our land to trucking and to raising trees and giving up the traditional Iowa farm crops and way of life. And that way we got to keep our farm, which meant we got to keep our country living and our neighbors and our town and our community that we'd grown up in. So that was worth it.
Heart was left on a piece of land, out in the country working with my hands. Now I dress in a suit and tie, working to live, but my dreams won't die, and it's alright. You can change, and it's alright to be that way. Yeah.
You've been listening to musician, playwright, engineer, and rural resident of Iowa, Joe Hanek, and selections from the musical that he and his mother, Angie Hanek, produced called Farmer Song. Hanek was interviewed in August of 2007.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts today, Paul Wearson, together with Ursula Rudenberg. And we want to thank you for tuning in today and joining us. Well, we were just listening to a mini-documentary produced by Ursula back in 2007 when she got to know Joe Hanek. Joe was the son of an Iowa farm family and grew up during the farm crisis in the 1980s. And, well, let's talk about what happened and where we are today. Neil Harrell is with us here at KHOI to help us break it down. And Dr. Harrell is a Charles F. Curtis Distinguished Professor in Agriculture at Iowa State University, Emeritus Professor of Economics, and former Director of the Center for International Agricultural Finance. Also, Neil is a member of the Iowa Bar. Welcome to our show today, Neil, and maybe you can sort this all out for us.
Well, thank you very much. In the time we have this morning, I want to just simply thank you for the opportunity to hear the program that preceded us here. It brought back so many memories to me. I grew up just about 65 miles east of where that farm was located near Beaconsfield, Iowa. And when my father delivered a load of hogs in 1932, he got to the bank just as it was closing, and they opened the door and locked it. He deposited his check. The bank never opened. Mm-hmm. And he preached from that time forward, never borrow money. And he didn't. He paid cash for everything, cash for land. He died in 77. I'm sure if he had been alive during the 80s, he would have said, aha, I told you so. Mm-hmm. But my brother and I were a little different to cut, and we kept pressing for more modern equipment. We had horses until I was 13 years old. So I understand fully the pain and suffering that so many went through during that time period. It probably was the most painful economic downturn in the agricultural sector since the Great Depression. And it was notable for several reasons. First of all, we lost 63% of our land value. And so even if you were careful, you were going to lose a lot of equity during that time period. Two-thirds of the debt was held by one-third of the farmers. That was a big problem because it was the farmers who lacked strong equity positions who were hit the hardest. Those who were older and had quite a bit of a cushion, financial cushion, they were able to ride through it. And they were a little bit unhappy about the attention that all their youngers were getting because they said, we went through that. Why couldn't they? Well, the difference was that the policy that caused this whole thing, the Fed policy, Federal Reserve policy, simply hit the younger ones who had the debt. And they were heavily younger, not always. Mm-hmm. The most heavily indebted tended to be the younger, the ones who had not built up much equity. Those with considerable equity were not always as sympathetic even to the problems. Now, why did it happen?
Could you explain the equity?
Yes. Equity is your net worth. It's your assets minus your debt. And that is your equity in it.
And in this case, it would be land?
Well, land and machinery and livestock. Oftentimes, the land is what's bearing the big burden of debt. There may be debt against cattle, hogs, anything, machinery. And one of the problems that when the Fed slammed on the monetary brakes on October the 6th, 1979, it threw a bunch of farmers into the windshield. Now, let me explain how we got to that point.
Okay.
There were several factors that coalesced during this decade of the 70s that set the stage for the farm debt crisis. One was that we had a lot of grain sales to the Soviets starting about 1972, corn, wheat, and soybeans, and that caused prices to rise spectacularly up to that point, and didn't last very long, about a year and a half, and the prices fell back to normal levels. However, the memories continued. And there was talk about the golden age of agriculture. We would never again have low commodity prices. Also, the Fed was playing a game of loose money, loose credit, if you will. They were allowing inflation to rise. Inflation was quite high during the 1970s. Yet it caused those who were borrowing money to take risks, because if you went in to see your banker and you proposed buying the 80 across the road, and they say, well, I don't think you're strong enough. Well, I'm pretty sure I can handle it. So they march out of the bank. They buy it, come back in a year later and say, now, if I'd listened to your advice, I would not have that 80. Now it's worth 15% more. And that encouraged people to go further and further into debt. And it caused some banks to become a little bit less strict in terms of their requirements. And so the consequence was also that the high inflation rate and the fairly low rate of interest, which sometimes two quarters during that time period was actually less than the rate of inflation, which is a prescription for disaster, when you can just sit there and do better than you would otherwise. And so what happened was that the country decided through the Federal Reserve that had to stop. And they appointed a new head of the Fed, and that was Paul Volcker, August of 1979. The meeting on October 6, 1979, slammed on the monetary brakes. We're going to have tight money, and we're going to solve this thing. And the only way to solve a high rate of inflation is to get stern with short-term interest rates. And that's what happened. Interest rates started up. But they thought that they would throw the election in 1980, so they eased back. And about a month after the 80 election in December of 1980, they slammed on the brakes again, this time for good.
And when you say slamming on the brakes, what does that mean?
High interest rates. Tight money policy causes interest rates to rise. And the people who
had... So they raised the interest rates.
Raised the interest rates. Mm-hmm. And interest rates went up to about 21%. And so this was for short-term money. And because of the inflation interest rate relationship during the 70s, it encouraged short-term borrowing. If they'd had this on long-term borrowing, 30-year loan, for example, the interest rates didn't change that much. But the short-term rates did. And so it really punished those who were financing with short-term interest rates. The Fed, through tightening the money supply, caused the interest rates to rise, mm-hmm. to bring inflation under control. That was believed at the time, and still really is a way to control inflation, is to increase interest rates. And so they went up to the point where many couldn't make their payments, mm-hmm. as was true in the case we've just heard here. So that was one big factor. Another was that rules on land financing were eased in the early 70s. There was a lot of political pressure to do that. And so they eased back on the federal land bank loan terms, and a lot of the other lenders followed suit to a degree. And so that was a second factor. Third, the memories of the high commodity prices were still there. The prices fell back in 73, 74, but the memories continued. And so people thought, well, the way we're going here, I better get the 80 and 160 nearby bought while it's still low. We heard reference through that whole period that we'll never see low prices again. The golden age of agriculture had really arrived. Well, so it started October 6, 79, and that was the point at which we could see that we were going to have problems, but it wasn't widely understood for about two more years. We saw a few going over the edge, but it wasn't until the 80s. Well, I wrote a 10-page or a 10-article series in a banking publication in 1982. I used the term bankruptcy because I was trying to warn what mm-hmm. was going to come about if we continued the way we were going. And I was criticized by the editor. He said, we've never in the history of this publication used the term bankruptcy. Can't you find some other term? And I said, no, if we are so sensitive that we can't use the term bankruptcy, we're be even more trouble than I thought.
Right. Well, that's the term Joe used, too, in
yes,
his story.
Yes, yes. So the upshot of it was we had two-thirds of the farmers who were largely debt-free or they could handle it. But the third of the farmers who had two-thirds of the debt were in trouble, and they started slowly falling over the edge. The first public recognition of this was in May of 1984. That's when several things happened. I was testifying in Washington and went to Jim Leach's office. He was the first district representative in Congress in the House. For lunch, he invited me because he knew I had some ideas about what to do about this. And he proposed a bill, which got introduced. And that evening out at the the Red Carpet Club of United Airlines. I did something I'd never done before. I triggered a newspaper story. I called George Anthon, who then was the Des Moines Register Washington correspondent, the chief of that office. And I explained what we had been through that day because I had presented this proposal to Representative Leach and all the rest of the delegation was represented there. The next morning, the Register carried a story, and it really launched a huge debate. And I was criticized roundly for focusing attention on something that wasn't even believed to be a problem. But it turned out it was a problem, very, very severe problem. So question now is, what's going to happen this time? Mm-hmm. Are we heading to another farm debt crisis? And I don't think we are. And the reason is that we have a different Fed policy today. Fed policy is a tighter money policy. And although interest rates are very low right now, the Fed is thinking about raising them. But they're worried more about the economic vitality of the country than they are about inducing people to borrow too much. But it's a different thought process that's going through in Washington, and I think that will have an impact here. Memories of the 80s are still there, and programs like we've heard this morning will help people remember that there is a problem here. When you get into a situation where you're vulnerable and you can't make your payments. Debt is not concentrated like it was back then in the hands of the least able to handle it. And so the situation is sufficiently different that we really don't think that we're headed into that kind of a situation again. However, there's going to be failures, and there already have been. And they are heavily so far focused on those who were the larger farmers, not the smaller ones, who had aggressively entered into lease contracts, rent contracts on land they were renting, and 3, 4, 5 years ahead and paying 400 to 500 acres cash rent, or the $300 even cash rent. And some of those have already gone over the edge. And these are large operators, some over 10,000 acres. Also, the farm equipment dealers are not selling equipment like they were. And so there may be some pullback there as well. So we really think that inflation is low right now. We don't face the same kind of issues we did back then. So we really don't think we're going to have another farm debt crisis. But that's not to say there aren't some who are going to be hurt. They clearly will be. In that time period, in the 1980s, there was a special bankruptcy chapter adopted by Congress in 1986. It's called Chapter 12. And it helped to rescue some of the farmers, and I suspect time-wise that the one we've just heard probably would have been helped with Chapter 12. Mm-hmm. But many of them had already gone over the edge by that time, and so we still have Chapter 12. It was permanent, made permanent about 2 or 3 years ago. It was temporary until then. But it essentially adopts the idea that we were trying to push during the 80s of trying to restructure debt. The traditional approach was if your borrower is in trouble, then foreclose on them, try to collect, sell their property, try to get your hands on it and get it sold. But when everybody or almost everybody up and down the road is in trouble, that drives the market down for the value of machinery and equipment and land. We lost 63% of our land value during the period 81 to 86. 63%. We lost 38 banks in Iowa. Most of the banks that failed were west of I-35 and north of I-80, and that's not the poorest part of Iowa, but that's where the bank failures were the greatest.
Yeah, our local bank in Story City failed.
It did.
These were people who were part of our community, known to us for decades. Son and father were bankers and that sort of thing. The interesting thing about agriculture, you know, you look at history, and we had the Great Depression, you know, starting in 1929 through the 30s.
Right.
But actually, farming was in depression even in the 20s before the massive depression happened. So the things that happen out on the farm are not necessarily coefficient with the stuff that happens elsewhere in the economy, because they were in a depression for most of the 20s, weren't they, Neil?
Yes. Actually, the downturn began shortly after World War I, and the period of the 20s was painful. And the chief economist of USDA was trying to get the government to understand just how difficult it was. And at one point, he got fired. And that was an indication that markets will take care of this. Don't worry about it. We don't need to intervene. And there was talk about export policy. There were talk about all kinds of things during the 20s, but they didn't really solve the problem. And then in the 30s, it really, really hit. Mm-hmm. And I can remember in the fall of 36, my dad told my mother we have $100 to get through the winter and put the crop in. And I didn't realize then, I was 3 years old, just exactly how much that, how serious that was. But it was close. And I remember him telling my mother also, if we don't get, he rented a little bit better farm. He said, if this doesn't work out, the next move is to the poorhouse. Later, we were going to Centerville, the county seat, and we passed what they called the poorhouse. I said, is this where we were going to move to? And they chuckled because it was pretty much up from that point forward. But it was tough and had been for quite some time, starting right after World War I, actually.
And so, everybody says that farming, you know, changes happen, but there's also cyclical things that happen in farm economy, as in all the economies. And you think that when things are going well and prices are high, that this is continuously sustainable. And history tells us it never is.
No. Farmers are the world's best economic citizens. Give them half an economic incentive to increase production every time and drive the price back down again. Mm-hmm. They're their own best assurance that we're really not going to have permanent problems with price fixing and that type of thing. Because there's so many farmers. They increase production. Mm-hmm. Even when prices go down, they do, because the only solution for them is to produce more, even though they're going to lose some. So it's an interesting situation. We don't see very many sectors now that have that kind of numbers. If you're in the steel business or you're in petroleum, whatever, there are so few involved that they can get together and when supply becomes too great, they can cut back on production. But you can't convince farmers to do that because there's so many of them.
Farming's done on a different scale today, but they're still very independent people.
They are.
You know, when I grew up on our section, we had four landowners. Each landowner had beans, corn, alfalfa, and an oats harvest in midsummer. Now that section today, as I speak, is one quarter beans and the rest is all corn. So
this raises another point that I want to make, and that is talk about the impact on the communities. Mm-hmm. There was something else going on besides the farm debt crisis, and that is the two revolutions, the technology of seed and genetics and the technology of power. Mm-hmm. My wife and I own land in Appanoose County, and what we own was 12 homesteads at the turn of the century. Yeah. The 19th, the 20th century, 12 families. Today, our tenant farms all that and some more in addition. And so you just don't need as many people.
And the change is because
it hurts the local community.
Right.
Economy of scale. Right. When you look at churches in the country, boarded up business districts, everything then was based on the assumption that there would be four farm families in every section. And that ain't no longer true.
That's right. Exactly.
You know, we're running out of time, Neil. We'd like to have you back again. This has been a fantastic
program. Very interesting.
Program.
I always enjoy it. It's painful. I wrote a book, The Farm Debt Crisis, the 80s, Iowa State University Press, 1990. And every time I open it up, it makes me unhappy. It makes me angry because we tried so very hard to try to get the attention of Washington. And it was an uphill battle. And finally, there were enough who felt strongly that something needed to be done. But we had three crises. It was made of the savings and loan debacle. Mm-hmm. And there were some big banks in trouble because they had made loans in South America. And they kept telling us when we were in there, look, there are three crises today, and you're number three. And you're in here trying to convince us that you should be number one. And we said, no, but we do believe we should be ranked at least. Mm-hmm. We had a meeting in the White House in 19 19- 85. And Paul, David Stockman, who was head of OMB, Office of Management Budget, came in with his long hair, and he started criticizing us right away. The governor was there, and we had a small group of about four or five. And he said, you caused the problem. It was all land contracts. So we had to get him straightened out on that. Mm-hmm. And then they got into a shouting match between him and the governor and some others, because he said, this government does not believe in that. And when the Secretary of Agriculture, seated across the table, started to speak up and say, I know there are problems out there, he said, and he used an expletive, he said, block, this is a private meeting, you don't need to talk like that, you may have to in private. This government does not believe in intervention. And so we went up on the hill and talked to Paul Volcker then after that, and he said, your problem is down there. And he waved his big arm down toward the Congress and the White House. He said, we're not going to change our policy. We have to keep a sound economic system. And he said, we're going to stay the course.
Yep.
Repeat again the name of your book.
The book is The Farm Debt Crisis of the 1980s.
Okay.
Iowa State University Press, 1990. Iowa State University Press was sold, and the publisher who ended up with it is in New York. And there were still a few copies until 2007 when we started the housing crisis. And I got an email saying, Harl, we've been looking, surfing the net, and looks like you came up with some ideas back then that might help us now. Do you think so? I said, yes. And so I wrote a letter. We were in our condo in Hawaii at the time. I sent that off to every senator, and it came within six votes of passing three times in 2008. But the banks and the bank lobbyists didn't like it. Uh-huh. And they called me. One of the biggest banks called me, and we spent 2 hours on the phone arguing about this.
Wow.
And they later told me, if we had followed your advice, we would not have cost the bank as much as we ended up suffering. Mm-hmm. So we don't learn too much, but we learn a little bit each time.
A little bit at a time.
That was one of the examples.
Okay, we got to go.
And history repeats itself, and life is cyclical. Yeah. Thank you very much, Neil Harl. We've been listening to local talk shows today on KHOI Radio. We explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa, and thank you for joining us today. I've been your host, Paul Wearson, together with Ursula Rudenberg, and we've been speaking about the economics of farming in Iowa with Dr. Neil Harl, a Charles F. Curtis Distinguished Professor in Agriculture at Iowa State University, and Emeritus Professor of Economics, former Director of the Center of International Agricultural Finance also. He's a member also of the Iowa Bar. Earlier in the show, we listened to a mini-documentary about the farm crisis of the 1980s, which was produced by co-host Ursula in 2007.
The production featured Joe Hanick, the son of a farm family in southern Iowa who grew up during the farm crisis. He described the experience of growing up with this event and how he saw it affect not only his family but the whole community.
Local Talk on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. today and always. You can also listen to today's entire Local Talk show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org, and that's khoifm.org. There you will find information about the people you heard today on the show, along with contact information and links to the people, places, and things we talked about.
Local Talk was engineered by Richard Morrison. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You also heard music by Joe Hanick from his CD, Farmer Song, which was musical pieces in his acclaimed musical From the Farm Crisis, performed in 2007, also called Farmer Song. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop, as well as a radio show, which means you can be part of our team if you wish to learn how to work with us and be one of our reporters. We will train you. You can contact us at 292-2878, 292-2878, or you can write to us at khoiradio@gmail.com.
And if you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience makes KHOI possible and meaningful, too. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.